Welcome to Beyond Carbon, the podcast where we find out how investors are thinking about climate change, sustainability, ESG, and a whole range of related issues beyond carbon.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Beyond Carbon. I'm your co-host, Chris Ito, and today, George Dyer and I sit down for a discussion with Jeff Gitterman. Now, a lot of you who have been involved with the sustainable investing space know Jeff from his work as both an investment advisor and an asset manager. He's been in the business for more than 30 years. His firm is well known, and he's really been one of the industry's most recognized voices when it comes to ESG and climate change. And one of the reasons we wanted to have Jeff on the show is that if you've read his publications or watched him on TV, he's what I would call a pragmatic advocate for incorporating sustainability. And those are my words and not his. And I think with so much division in society and having ESG and climate change caught up in those divisions, we thought it would be a good idea to talk to a person who literally puts himself at the center of these debates. And I think what I've always found interesting about Jeff is that he tries to find common ground between those who would advocate staunchly for ESG and those who might shun it. And we cover that particular topic during our chat today. And we also get Jeff's take on the investment opportunities he sees in the climate solution space, namely around infrastructure, and also the risks posed by climate change, particularly the manifestation of physical risks, and how those physical risks will ultimately act as sort of a canary in the coal mine, so to speak, to get investors to take action. So I'm not going to sit here and say that this was the most uplifting discussion I've ever had about solving the climate crisis, but it certainly was pragmatic, realistic, and it makes you think about the fact that we have to broaden the tent, so to speak, and try to meet people and investors where they are. And we have to do our best to listen, even to people who might not agree with our point of view. So sit back and enjoy the conversation with Jeff Gitterman. Before we begin today's episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that the content provided in this podcast is for informational purposes only. The following discussion does not constitute professional investment advice, and listeners should not make any financial decisions based on the content of this podcast. Now, let's get started with the show.
Hi, Jeff. How are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, George. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you. So yeah, what's been on your mind lately in the world of sustainable investing?
Wow. Heaviness? I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, isn't it?
I did have a discussion with someone yesterday about climate anxiety and how that's prevailing. A lot of professionals in the group that are working on all of the problems that we all try to work on, but I think mostly it's, you know, the conflicts around ESG and the political environment around ESG. And it's also the fact that, you know, we just don't see enough movement on climate, which is just always tough.
Yeah, the climate anxiety piece is definitely real. I mean, having worked in this area for a long time, I'm definitely feeling it more now, more acutely now than in past years. I think as we see more of the impacts and as time marches on and we still haven't seen the action that we know we need, it's a little scary.
I don't know if you know this, but I got into physical risk of climate as an investment theme almost 10 years ago because I just, looking forward, didn't see that the political will was there to address the problems. And also, I just had not any knowledge or any facts around it, just an intuition that was whatever was coming out on the reports that I would get to see was probably sugarcoated a bit, knowing scientists as well as I do. And as you know, I work in the college market, so I have lots of scientists as clients. By the time something gets published that has to be approved by multiple parties, it's usually a watered-down version. So we just always expected that physical risk would exacerbate much faster than anyone was really counting on.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I mean, I'm curious, you know, you mentioned that the political will wasn't there, hasn't been there. And that was a big part of why I sort of was interested in focusing on and working with investors too, is because I've, you know, figured that when when investors saw the data and saw the real impacts of these physical risks, that they would take action, you know, to protect their investments or to invest wisely. And I'm just curious, in that context, you know, what is your take now that we're seeing this pushback over the last couple of years on this whole concept of investors, you know, kind of having the freedom to take those risks into consideration, and, you know, policymakers and this kind of media campaign looking to not allow ESG investing or not allow the consideration of those risks? I mean, what do you make of that, you know, in terms of where it's coming from and why?
Yeah. You know, I used to talk, well, I still do talk a lot, but when I used to go to conferences that were really just ESG conferences prior to COVID, I was watching the industry, and this is our side of the industry that I'm talking about, taking credit for there being alpha in ESG and starting to label a bunch of product ESG funds. And I was one of the few people, there were others like Erica Carr, but I was one of the few people that was outspoken about the fact that it was incredibly misleading the way that they were portraying ESG, especially the funds that were specifically naming themselves ESG funds and were really just indexes that overweighted some top line scoring methodology and underweighted some bottom line scoring methodology. I just said we were setting ourselves up for failure, and that most of the alpha that they were claiming was really biased because it was sector biases. It was, you know, overweight large cap tech growth and underweight fossil fuels. And that trade worked for a number of years until it didn't work anymore. And I just think we weren't thoughtful enough about how we were trying to spread the message. And we got some much needed pushback. Now, everything always goes too far on either side. So we went too far kind of on our side, and they're going way too far, you know, attacking ESG. And we didn't spend enough time educating the industry on what was the difference between values and value. And, you know, I've written about this extensively. I think what we were all looking for was to focus on value and sustainability. It's about creating long-term value. We allowed the fact that we layered ourselves onto the old SRI movement to get a kickstart to really blur the lines between values investing and value, and then open the window for the fossil fuel industry, the Koch brothers, the Cato Institute, to jump on attacking it from a values perspective. And if we had done it right initially, that never could have happened, but we did.
So, Jeff, you know, the this notion of labeling around ESG and the difficulty that I think some market participants have in explaining, you know, what they mean by it. Do you think that the market will move, or is it moving toward sort of redefining these different components between sort of a more values-based approach, ESG for risk management and security selection versus impact orientation and thematic investing? I mean, we've written a little bit about that too, about how the market needs to, you know, better define what they're talking about. Do you see that happening in your world, or not to the degree that it needs to?
So I get the benefit of working on both sides of this world, really three sides. I work with asset managers a lot, because we run an asset management side of the business. And I work with advisors a lot because we focus on educating advisors and providing asset management and model portfolios to advisors. And then I also work directly with clients. What I will say is that asset managers are not in any way stopping the use of ESG data as a source for stock selection. What they're doing is heavily reevaluating their marketing position on how they portray that or don't portray that right now. And it's swirling a bit because, you know, some people are focusing in on impact as the terminology. Some people are focusing in on sustainability as the terminology. Some firms are doubling down on ESG as the right terminology. And I think what's left, and I spent some decent time with Cerulli on the phone a couple of weeks ago, what's left is a very confused advisor. And that is harming the flows into sustainable investing, because the advisors are really like a deer in the headlights. The broker dealers, and I spent, you know, some time also talking to Investnet this week, the broker dealers are panicked about the new compliance investigations and focus coming out of FINRA on ESG. So they don't want to do anything of approving ESG models or platforms onto their onto the broker dealers. So I think we're in a figuring out mode right now. And I'm hoping what I always thought is ESG should kind of disappear as terminology, and it should just be good due diligence, and that those that cared about good due diligence would keep doing it, and those that don't wouldn't. But I think we got to get that away from the advisors and let the advisors understand what sustainability means and take that out of the realm of ESG as a talking point.
Yeah, and I'm interested, Jeff, when you talk about the differentiation between value and the values base, which I agree. And, you know, in our network, we're talking primarily about value and how this is better investing for the long term as endowments or long term investors. But it is always interesting where there is that overlap often of mission alignment or, you know, values alignment. And I think you can have both. But do you think that just confuses the conversation too much to even bring that into the picture?
Well, I mean, we always thought it was too hard for the advisor to drive that. So we created a product where we focus on value investing in the product, mostly focused on climate, with managers that do deep diligence about ESG, but lots of managers that don't have that in the name of the product. And we built that with active managers also, because we just have a belief that this is too complicated to do well passively, but you can argue both sides of that. And then we left the values conversation for the client, so the end client can check off boxes that they care about enough to be willing to take some tracking error on their portfolios for. That keeps the SEC off of your hands, because the end client is making that decision and you're not driving that decision. And we focus on really climate as the major risk in capital markets. The problem with that is markets move really slowly and then all at once. So, you know, like Michael Burry in Big Short, we can be right and we can be really right, but it could take a while for the markets to show that we're right. So it's, how do you do that without losing the client interest along the way? And that's tough to do. And I'm very open about the fact that we're constantly challenged by how to do that, because if we don't have good returns, the clients won't stick around long enough. So it's a challenge. But I think we all know we're right, that this is going to have a big impact on capital markets. The question is just when.
Right. We're finding that too, you know, in talking with investors, or we're getting that sense, getting back to what you sort of opened your comments with, which is that there's a little bit of even greater anxiety regarding the transition to a low carbon economy, the transition away from fossil fuels. And the more investors we talk to, I think are even, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure I want to say more skeptical, but clearly just as skeptical about the transitioning happening in a way that is going to be within the time horizon of their investment horizon, right? And I think that as sort of this depression or whatever you want to call about it relating to climate begins to permeate the discussion, the more and more investors are going to say, well, you know, this is not going to be a shift away or a transition away that is going to line up with my time horizon for value creation. Are you finding sort of the same thing when you talk to folks, or how are they thinking about, how are they thinking about sort of time horizon? Is it?
It's very dependent on a client's wealth, because theirs and AllianceBernstein has done some really good work on this with their behavioral finance guy. I can't think of his name right now, but there is a very big tracking alignment between as your wealth grows your care and concern for more than yourself and your kids grows. So as we see clients with more and more net worth who are really thinking legacy, their care about these things is actually very high. When you talk to mass affluent clients who, you know, are still worried about whether they have enough for retirement and whether they'll be able to pass on anything to their kids, the care and concern for that gets much less. And that's a natural, you know, it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's just a natural progression of how safe someone feels with their investments. What we try to focus on in the mass affluent space is risk avoidance and opportunity around climate. So we try to really just focus the client in on there are certain risks that you can price out of your portfolio, and there's no risk premium right now because the market's not pricing in the risk at all anymore. So you could avoid, you know, a REIT that has a lot of exposure to Houston. You can avoid municipal bonds that are mostly Florida bound. You can get the same rating, the same term, the same interest rate in Rochester, New York, that has, you know, almost no climate exposure compared to Tampa. So there's ways to start reducing risk. And then there's opportunities with the IRA bill and other things, such as mass investment coming into, you know, certain spaces of the market. We need huge infrastructure built out in our electric grid. And you can sell that as a AI story and a climate story, because it has to be both right now. I mean, the demand for infrastructure to support AI manufacturing is off the charts right now, and it's not even begun. It's in its, you know, infancy. I mean, it's going to outstrip New York's demand, some of the current plants that they have being built out. So we try to talk about it in today's, you know, without making it a doom scenario.
Yeah.
And that usually keeps the client on board, honestly.
You know, you touched on physical risk a couple of times. How about transition risks? And do you find that clients are, you know, sort of better positioned to understand one or the other? Do you talk about them separately? Do you tend to package it together when you're giving advice? Talk a little bit about transition risk, if you would, in that context.
We've always been more focused, not that we don't cover it, and we've written papers about both, but we've always been more focused on physical risk and talking with clients. We think it's much easier to understand. I can talk to, you know, a Republican in Texas about flood risk in Houston. They get it. They see it. I can talk to people in Florida about, you know, building collapse due to underground, you know, seawater getting in and destroying the infrastructure. So that it's a much easier conversation. When you start to bridge into transition risk, you have to be much more careful about who your audience is, because there's a sense that, you know, there's been enough propaganda that there's a sense that anything that's anti-fossil fuel is anti-American right now. So you've got to tread lightly in that area. And again, it goes to wealth, because the wealthier clients that we talk to want to invest in a future where their generations, who will have their legacy for multiple generations, because they have, you know, tens of millions of dollars, just care more. And I don't want to say, I want to be really careful, because they have the capacity to care more because of the sense of security and safety that they have with their money. Most people are still grappling with the fear of loss and sense of security around having enough. It's very few people that get to the point where, okay, I really have enough here. Like, unless I'm a complete moron, I'm not going to lose this pot. To then start caring about what's next. What am I leaving? What are my kids going to remember me for? So you really have to know your audience. And advisors haven't had to do that. You know, advisors have, you know, learned, especially the older advisors that are, you know, dominate the space right now, you know, learn keep, you know, sex, politics, and religion off the table when you're having a conversation with your client, and, you know, just sell them what they need. So it's difficult for most of those advisors to jump into this, you know, pool and, yeah. and really feel comfortable and safe having these conversations. It's a younger advisor's game, and yeah. it'll take time for them to inherit, you know, the older advisor's books and start dominating the space.
Yeah. Can we talk about institutions maybe a little bit? And I'll bring George into this conversation as well, because I think one of the things you said about, you know, the advisor market and the, you know, those that sort of have more the means, right, can consider these issues more so. How about when we think about sort of the institutional market, the endowment market, and maybe I'll sort of draw a parallel between what you said to sort of those institutions that may be, let's say, liberal arts institutions in the Northeast versus state universities in the middle of the country or in the South. Would you say that sort of your approach, if you were going to sort of advise them or counsel them on incorporating some of these considerations, whether it be ESG or climate, would be similar? So in other words, right, we've got the groups sort of in the Northeast, the more smaller liberal arts colleges that perhaps their stakeholders would resonate better with the notion of transition risk, whereas maybe that's a topic that politically you might want to touch in the Midwest. Can you comment on some of that from your experience? And I'd like to hear from George, yeah. too. I mean, because that's sort of right up, you know, the IEN's alley, I think.
Well, I can take a minute and then pass it to George. You know, I'm very transparent about who I am and what I care about. So I, you know, have a big following in public social media and LinkedIn. I have a TV show and a firm. So people know where I stand by the time they've met me, typically. And, you know, I just try very hard to listen to someone's point of view about what they think before I tell them what I think. And it's not for me to tell anybody what to think. So I think there's a very nuanced approach to being in this space and not getting upset every time someone disagrees with you, and being able to listen and hear people with different points of view. This world has gotten much too divided. I try to ask questions, you know, are you concerned about the legal risk in owning fossil fuels? There's multiple lawsuits pending, 2,100 internationally against these companies. They're starting to lose some of these, you know, major lawsuits, which could have a long-term impact on price. You know, they've tended to underperform for decades up until a recent upsurge because of the war in Russia and Ukraine. Do you feel comfortable having that exposure just based on a political will? Can we talk really about what is the long-term viability of these companies? And then at some point, you know, they're not getting enough money for new exploration and drilling. They're going to run out of some of the cheaper ways of producing, and that's going to get more difficult for them too. So there's a lot of headwind. I just ask people how they feel about it and try to let them come to their own conclusions about it.
Yeah, and I'd say we take a really similar approach within the Intentional Endowments Network. You know, recognizing that all endowments are so different, you know, even if they're similar institution types or similar parts of the country. And, you know, that was in a large part where the name came from too. We think all endowments should be intentional in thinking about these issues. And, you know, we're not here to be prescriptive in exactly what response they should take. And there's lots of different responses and lots of different ways to approach all of this. So that's kind of our orientation. And I think, you know, as you said, Jeff, with the physical risks becoming so apparent around climate change, you know, certainly there's stakeholder pressure, but this is also just becoming more mainstream within the investment industry broadly because they're real risks and real opportunities. And, you know, you mentioned some of the opportunity side with the Inflation Reduction Act and, you know, just we've seen it for years with the cost of renewables coming down and the transition happening. And it's, you know, I think it's always difficult to navigate in times of great change, and we're certainly in that right now. And I'm just curious how you think about that and how you talk to your clients around the opportunity set and, you know, just the complexity there, that it's not necessarily so easy to say, oh yeah, let's just invest in all renewables, because there's lots of different dynamics in that. And so, yeah, how do you think about the opportunity set in these conversations?
Yeah, I mean, we have been very heavily focused on infrastructure and water, where you can make a case both for energy infrastructure and water infrastructure and grid infrastructure, all three segments, that regardless of any kind of climate pressure or transition pressure, there's a decaying of our current infrastructure. We're not a new young country anymore. We were for, you know, a couple hundred years. Now we're not. And a lot of our infrastructure is decaying and it needs massive investment. And a lot of these companies have monopolistic, or oligopic tendencies where they're not in competition and they have to put a lot of money to work and they will benefit from that. I mean, some water distribution pipes, you know, they get less than 60% of flow right now, where the capacity, you know, was 100% at one point. So 40% of that pipe is air going through. So it's easy to have that conversation without, delving into a political landmine. Same thing with the CHIPS bill. I mean, I think AI makes a really good case for the need for infrastructure build out and also risk. A lot of these companies are international companies that have net zero commitments. Whether you approve of them or not, Europe's not shying away from, you know, a lot of these net zero commitments. Or SEC looks like they're coming out with some proposals in March, the last I have heard. And these companies are building megawatt facilities that need green energy to supply and support them in order to meet their future commitment. So there's this huge opportunity. And then I had this chart where it shows the inflation adjusted investment in the transition economy versus every other government funded investment in history, going back to the Great Wall of China. And it's like all these low bars. And then, you know, even for like the space race and the internet and World War II. And then there's this huge bar that is, you know, $1 trillion going into a green transition. And we just talked to clients about that. Like, this is the biggest trade that we know of. Why wouldn't you want to have some money alongside of it, regardless of your political persuasion yeah. or whatever you think? Like, if someone had said to you, you know, we're building spaceships, you put a couple of percent of your portfolio towards that, like, especially if the government's backing it. There's no risk for the businesses underneath because they're getting so much funding from the government. And on the risk side, I just want to touch on this because it's what we wrote about in 19, so we started really working on it in 17, but the paper we wrote in 2019 called The Great Repricing, we were very specific, really, that insurance would be the, you know, first domino to go, or the canary in the coal mine. And I just got off the phone with someone that lives in Winter Park, Colorado. They live in a large development that has an HOA policy. So each homeowner doesn't need their own homeowner's insurance because they're a big townhouse development. They have a $150 million policy. And that policy was basically dropped. Their current carrier said they're not renewing it. They got four bids for a new policy. A fire broke out near Winter Park recently. Didn't touch the development, but came close. Three of the bidders dropped out of the bid. So they were left with one bid that they had to take. 13x, so not a 13% increase, 13 wow. times the current premium, and they would only give them a 9-month policy. This is Ooh. The reality that's coming quickly. Yep. You're starting to finally read about it in Forbes, and the Wall Street Journal even had an article this weekend about insurance risk and what that can do to the markets. So that's where we focus on the risk. And we say, you know, reinsurers are not political entities. They're multinational corporations that will only provide product and pricing where it's profitable for them. And if the states limit their ability to raise premiums, they will exit the states. And citizens in Florida is one hurricane. Yeah, I mean, they're one Category 5 hurricane away from going bankrupt. And then what starts happening to real estate values if you can't get homeowners insurance in Florida at a reasonable price?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, canary in the coal mine for sure. Yeah. Hey, I want to go back to something you said about infrastructure and in particular the grid, because, you know, one thought that we have, and we talk to our clients about this as well when they're thinking about renewables or investing in climate solutions. And that is, from an infrastructure standpoint, you could almost consider that a little bit of a diversifier as well. I don't know if you agree with that point within your portfolio of energy solutions or clean energy solutions. And I think that sort of aligns with some of what, you know, you talked about. Have you found that to be true? I think the grid infrastructure held up reasonably well, given the downturn in some of the equity prices of sort of clean energy or renewable stocks.
Yeah, we've been, I don't want to say lucky, but somewhat lucky that, you know, we avoided some of the ownership of wind and solar and focused much more on infrastructure and grid build out. And in 22, that, you know, really went in our favor and helped support the portfolios tremendously. And we have a decent weight to them, so it's not a small portion of our portfolio combined. But, you know, in 23, they didn't do so well because they are very interest rate sensitive. You know, we've talked to clients, we've actually overweighted them going into 24 because we think that something will break. I mean, I want to be really clear. I think inflation is stickier, and we've been writing about that for 2.5 years publicly, and it's all over our website. We thought inflation would be much stickier, and some of that has to do with how we feel about climate change and the impacts of climate change being inflationary. And in every El Nino year, there's been a kind of 3-5% hit to inflation because of larger storms, more droughts, more rainfall. So there's a history for El Nino years being inflationary. But we've also been very clear that we think at some point something will break in the economy and interest rates will come down this year precipitously. And that will bode really well for utilities. I mean, if you track the history of utilities and infrastructure, in years where interest rates drop, they have huge rallies in those years. So last year was a really tough year. You know, I mean, last year was a tough year if you didn't own NVIDIA. So I think there was basically one stock to own last year. If I get one more call from a client saying, why don't I own more NVIDIA? That's when I know it's time to sell NVIDIA. But anyway. Yeah, but I agree with you. I think it's a huge diversifier. And I say to clients all the time, you know, you're not hiring me. You should be making your own money and you should be hiring me to preserve your money. I'm not the guy you hire to make you a lot of money. Mm. I'm the guy you hire to make sure that all the hard work you've done to save this money doesn't go to waste.
Yeah.
So if that's what you're looking for, I'm your guy. If you're looking for the guy that's going to put all your money in NVIDIA at the right time and ride the wave and get you out in time, you need a different advisor than that.
Yep. Well said.
And Jeff, what about, you know, just let me hear your thoughts on how, you know, other managers are approaching this whole space. And, you know, we talked a little bit at the beginning of the conversation about the language and some of the marketing and shifts to marketing. But, you know, do you see kind of the mainstream shops taking this on in meaningful ways? Do you think it's some of the more sort of boutique sustainable investment managers that are doing all of this well, or is it a total mix in your mind about where this market's heading?
You know, I think it's the right leadership. So it always goes back to leadership. I mean, where the leadership is good, companies are doing a really good job. And that could be, you know, a Schroders or American Century, or it could be a Sage or Stance Capital. It could be across the board from micro managers to, you know, large institutional, national or global managers. You know, that's why I think it's important to talk to the leadership and get a sense of what is it that they care about. I mean, I think everyone right now is talking about marketing because, you know, they're getting FINRA hit, they're getting SEC hit, they're getting pushback from, you know, the state Republican attorney general's offices. It's just everywhere. It's having a really damaging effect, especially on the VC, DE&I space, where they're going after, you know, minority founders or VCs that are funding minority founders. And mm-hmm. these companies can't afford those lawsuits. And the, you know, Koch brothers and the Cato Institute are funding a lot of lawsuits. So I think it's having a really damaging effect on those people. I think the asset managers will get through it, They'll change their marketing a bit. They'll avoid some public statements that maybe they were making before, and they'll be really careful to dot their I's and cross their T's and be more neutral in their marketing approach. And they'll survive it. But I do worry deeply about the really focused D&I, VC, and private equity world.
How about your view on sort of continuing on with the managers that may be more sort of the pure play managers when it comes to sustainability and climate, and those larger ones who sort of offer the strategy as part of a whole host of other different types of strategies? In your mind, if you were doing sort of allocations to managers, how much of that, how much of having a pure play focus, so to speak, drives your decision on whether to allocate capital to a manager or not? Or is that even a consideration if a more mainstream manager has demonstrated the expertise to do it, even though they're doing it basically based on client demand? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, we run core portfolios with anyone that is running a more diverse mainstream kind of portfolio. And then we are very specific about our thematic plays. So we want some really focused pure plays to kind of satellite our core portfolio. So we want large managers that are doing, you know, mid and SMID well, but care about the world that we're in and are trying to think deeply about it. You know, one of the things that I think, after being focused on this side of the industry for 10 years, that I'm maybe willing to admit is that nothing is black or white. There's just a lot of gray. You know, you can't end fossil fuels tomorrow. It's nice to say, and it's probably necessary to do, but you can't do it. There's just not enough energy solutions in renewable and green to take up the slack right now. So do you need nuclear? How do you feel about nuclear? People are starting to change their opinion about nuclear. We're pro-nuclear because we just don't see how you get to reduce CO2 emissions without nuclear being part of a solution process. So everything's gray. So I'm open to talking to everyone. I mean, we had, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, the guy that was running for president, on his fund on the show, his partner was on the show. I think I shared that episode with you guys. But I want to talk to everybody. I want to know where you stand and is there anywhere to meet in the middle anymore? But I also want to be really specific because we have very specific ideas and beliefs about what's happening in the world. And I want to invest some money cautiously along those very laser focused sectors of the market. And I think you have to have an investment team and you have to do the research and to be able to, you know, feel comfortable making those decisions. So I don't think that's for every advisor to do. I think every advisor should care that their mainstream asset manager cares about the future of the world. But for us, it's also important that we make some very focused bets.
Mm-hmm. In the context of that, I mean, what are your thoughts on, you know, you mentioned the SEC and like the fund naming rules. Do you think that will help or just create more confusion or just have people back off, even if they are doing some of this type of investing, they don't want to talk about it because they don't want to run into issues with their fund names?
Yeah, I think clarity will help. So I think right now there's just not enough clarity. Mm-hmm. I'm all for clarity, whether it goes my way or not. It's still better to know what you're dealing with. When you get confusion, you know, just like the market hates not knowing, you know. So if Biden and Trump are neck and neck, the market hates that. The market likes to know who's going to be president. Mm-hmm. They don't care, actually. I don't believe the market cares who's going to be president. They just want to know who's going to be president. And they prefer a lame duck Congress to, you know, an aligned Congress and president. So nothing can change. I think in our world, we just need clarity. And the SEC has been kind of floundering in getting these rules out. And that's mm-hmm. making it difficult for people to make decisions because you don't want to make a decision right now and have it be in 3 months you're getting audited for the decision that you just made and getting, you know, flagged for it. So I think it's really hard to do. right now. It's hard to work in this space right now. It's hard to get new people to commit to wanting to work in this space until we get a lot more clarity and these lawsuits go away and we get beyond it. I think it just makes it really tough.
Do you have any guess on a timeline for that? I mean, you know, I think any new market, new space goes through these sort of growing pains and maturation process. Do you see an end in sight?
I mean, I've been doing this for 33 years, I think, now. I can't remember a market product cycle that was political, though. Mm-hmm. Maybe tobacco would be the closest thing, but it wasn't, I don't know if it was necessarily political. It was just, you know, what, you know, corporate versus, you know, consumer. So this makes it a little tougher. I think if the Republicans get in, they'll spend a lot of time trying to dismantle a lot of good work that was done. I think Biden is underappreciated for a lot of bipartisan work that he was able to get done in a very toxic environment. I think history will go back in hindsight and say the amount of things that he actually got done in this environment was incredible, but he gets very little approval. The economy is not great. Inflation is worse than people are talking about, even the Democratic side, because the average consumer goes to the supermarket and every month prices are higher. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, car prices are higher. Auto insurance is higher. I mean, auto insurance is up like 20% year over year. It's hard. At the same time, when, you know, the five guys in this country, you know, increase their wealth by 280. I don't even know the exact number. I think it was like $1 trillion they increased their wealth by in the last 2 or 3 years. So I think it's a difficult environment to be working in. I think, like you said earlier, George, that this is a time of a lot of change and people are, you know, a little nervous. They're a little worn out. They're a little frazzled between COVID and politics and social media. So I think it will take a crisis of pretty epic proportion, and it will unfortunately probably happen, a climate crisis. I remember I asked Larry Fink this question about 8 years ago. I said, what will it take for the wealth management industry to start caring about climate change? And it was at the, I think it was at the SASB conference in New York. And he said, it will take a Category 5 hurricane on U.S. soil, not Puerto Rico, on direct U.S. soil to a major city to really wake people up that this is a problem.
That's unfortunate.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, you know, I think one of the things that George and I were really interested in having you on is that you give a pragmatic and honest assessment of what's happening in this whole sustainable investing space. And also your desire and your, not just your, you seek out people who may not, who have views that may differ from your own. And I think that's what George and I really appreciate this. And one thing that had struck me, I think, was something that you did either last year or 2 years ago, where you had on your TV show somebody who was sort of representing a oil and gas ETF versus a sustainable ETF, and you sort of moderated that. And maybe we could close this sort of with your observations or sort of what you learned from that, because you talked about the fact that, hey, we are in a divided country for sure. But that was an attempt to bring people together who had two differing views. You moderated it. And I thought that was really, really insightful. And kudos to you for doing that. But maybe you can close this with sort of your summary and observations from that particular experience.
I can, because I came away with one really clear finding from that. Aside from the fact that if there's a TV producer out there listening, I would want to bring back Counterpoint, which was a show that used to be on the weekends. I forget the guy that hosted it. He was great. I think he's passed since then. Nope. But I would love to do that on a weekly basis. Anyway, aside from that, I think what came out of that show was that what we were really disagreeing on was stakeholder capitalism versus shareholder capitalism. And it wasn't really about, I mean, yes, it was about fossil fuels too, but it was not about ESG. It was not about values. It wasn't about Christian values. It was literally about, should a company care about its stakeholders, or should it just be striving for profit for its shareholders? And what really dawned on me at the end of that conversation, when it really came down to that was their biggest disagreement, was if we really explain to people, like if you go out and say ESG is a bunch of values that's going to put, you know, trans people as president and they're going to run the world, and you sell it that way, and, you know, I could see, you know, right-wing Christian Republicans running for the hills. But if you go out and explain the truth of it, which they both expressed on the show, that it's really whether you care about the community and the employees and customers of the company that you're running, or you don't care about any of those people and you only care about the shareholders. And if you explain it to the average person and the average Republican or Democrat that way, I believe that, you know, 80% of this country would say, well, no, of course I want the company to care about the customers and the community and the employees of the company. Like, who would want to work for a company that doesn't? And if we can just focus it on that issue, I think everyone would want to do value-based investing. But we do, and George, you and I have talked about it, we just do it not a great as great a job marketing, because we don't have a coordinated group like the Cato Institute that's focused on one thing, getting a message out that destroys ESG and values-based investing. We have a multifaceted group of people that disagree a lot among each other, which is fine and healthy, but we don't have a coordinated effort that's well-funded to actually get these messages out clearly and transparently.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's well said, Jeff. Well said.
Absolutely. And we appreciate all the work you do to get that message out clearly and through all of your work and writing and TV show and everything. So we really appreciate you taking the time to hop on here and have this conversation with us. And look forward to keeping it going and seeing what we can do to move this work forward.
Thanks, George. Thanks, Chris. I really enjoyed the show.
Thanks,
Thank you.